dotted and draped in white lights that hang from lines, making it look like a Christmas tree. Both the Constitution and her sister ship, Independence, are docked in Honolulu, and as they leave, the crew instructs passengers to yell, "Aloha!" after the captain blasts the horn. So, when the horn bellows and reverberates in everyone's ears, 1,000 people yell in unison, "Aloha!" to the other ship, and 1,000 people on the other ship answer back. One ship makes its way to open water, and as soon as the bow clears the harbor, a nearby island shoots fireworks into the night. The night becomes the early hours of Sunday morning, and many people start the new day beneath a haze from the night before. Sundays are spent at sea, slowly cruising around the Hawaiian Islands. I am the unofficial opening act on the sun deck. Around noon, I wheel out a 300-pound block of ice onto the deck right next to the swimming pool. My job is to make an ice sculpture, but it's up to me what I make. The sculpture would be displayed later that night at the captain's party. Once I slide the block of ice off the metal handcart, I secure it at the base with a few damp rags so it wouldn't slide around the deck while I carved it with my chainsaw. That enormous ice cube catches everyone's eye. After the ice is secured, the youth counselors gather the kids on the cruise and arrange them on the deck so they get a front row seat a safe distance away from where I carved the ice. As soon as the cruise director announces me, I play to the crowd and wave and smile for pictures and video cameras. I always direct my first cuts into the ice with my chainsaw in a way that causes a stream of ice to fall on the children sitting nearby on the deck, who squeal with laughter. I love sculpting on deck on Sundays, but I have to work quickly under the warm Hawaiian sun. One particular day, a 6-year-old boy asks, "What is that block of ice made of, mister?" 7-Up, I reply matter-of-factly. Suddenly, a group of kids rush towards the ice and start licking it. I couldn't believe it. The adults smiled, but the youth counselors gave me a stern look as they gathered up the kids and sat them down again. "That doesn't taste like 7-Up," said one kid on his way back to his seat. I could tell he was disappointed that his 300-pound popsicle turned out to be a block of frozen water. My demonstration was usually followed by 10 minutes of pictures with passengers around the ice sculpture I had just made. Since we had to clear the deck of pieces of ice after my demonstration to make ready for the deck games, I would ask the 30 to 40 kids on deck to each grab a piece of ice and to make a wish and to then throw it overboard. This cleared the deck of ice in seconds. When I saw a few small kids struggling with a big piece of ice, I would tell them before they threw it over, "Be careful, don't hit the fish." They would give me a concerned look and then throw the piece of ice over the side. I use visual thinking to solve various problems. I'm in charge of overseeing the buffet at breakfast, and one day a waiter says, "Look, I see a dolphin," which causes a whole section of people to walk away from the buffet toward the big windows hoping to catch a look. For some reason, every person on a cruise wants to see a dolphin. I put the image into the vault of images in my mind. Another day, the breakfast buffet becomes very busy with so many passengers trying to get a meal in before leaving the ship for the day's excursion. The buffet is so full that we are unable to restock it with food. Ideally, restocking the buffet should be swift and nearly invisible, but it was impossible to do it in a polite manner with so many people on either side of the tables. I thought, if only I could clear away the people. Suddenly, I remembered the image of people shuffling over to the side of the room to see a dolphin, so I told one of the waiters, "Go over there and say you see a dolphin." "But I don't see a dolphin." "Just go there and see a dolphin," I say. "Oh, okay," he understands. He leans out the window. "Look, I see a dolphin," he says loudly. People holding serving spoons stop, and within seconds, a mass of people run over to the windows. People crowded there, all searching the ocean for this dolphin. "I don't see it," said one woman. Then one man said, "I see the dolphin. It's beautiful." Of course, there was no dolphin, and it was hard to keep myself from laughing out loud. But the idea worked, and the workers were able to restock the buffet. I used this solution whenever we encountered this particular problem, and it worked every time. The ocean has a unique character depending on where you are. When I lived in Napili Bay in Maui, I used to scuba dive at a place divers called Turtle Heaven. We never told tourists about it because we wanted to preserve it, so you could only visit if someone had showed you where to go. At a certain place along a beach, where the shelf suddenly drops off into deeper water, there was a really beautiful reef that was full of sea turtles, and on some seasons full of baby turtles. It was like a city of turtles against the pink, blue, orange, and green of the coral reef and sea plants. They glided through the water like they were flying. One place, Kahului, is on the other side of Maui. There's a sugarcane factory close to the shore that empties out sugary warm water into the sea, which attracts lots of sea turtles for some reason. One day, while the ship was docked, a stray sea turtle came to the side of the ship. It poked its head up toward the deck, which caught my attention because it was so unusual, so I leaned over the railing to throw some lettuce at it. I could see the turtle happily munching on the lettuce in the clear water. We only went to Kahului once a week, and the turtle visited me 5 more times over the next few weeks. I do wonder if perhaps it was actually 5 different turtles, but I prefer to believe it was the same turtle, and that we shared a human-turtle friendship that summer. Sometimes my travels led me to awkward ends. One day I found myself at a nude beach in Maui. It was the sort of place you had to know to find. It was marked by a rock jetty that ran up the beach. I went with a group from the ship. We climbed over the rocks to the nude beach, and it was full of people. I wasn't as ready to be nude as some of my friends, so I kept my swim trunks on. I passed on nude volleyball and instead decided to go for a swim. To my dismay, I got caught in a riptide. Before I knew it, I was swept in. I tried to swim back to the calmer waters closer to shore. In my mind, I thought, this wasn't the relaxing swim I had hoped for. But then I began to panic. I couldn't get out of it, and I was struggling. My distress must have been noticeable because next thing I knew, 2 naked guys were in the water next to me. They saved me, pulling me out of the water and helping me onto the sand where I lay exhausted. I was now surrounded by a small crowd of nude onlookers. I narrowed my eyes onto the patch of blue sky I could see above everyone. I thanked those who had saved me and found my friends. Remember to swim parallel to the beach if you are ever caught in a riptide, and to welcome aid no matter in what form it comes. Life is never dull on the ship. I am one of the chefs in command of a kitchen staff of 85 people. But the kitchen is fractured into groups. Italians, Filipinos, Germans, Micronesians, Hondurans, Egyptians, Polynesians, and Americans. Morale was low, and people only wanted to work with people from their own group. Some people said, "Well, we work better than the Filipinos, Americans, etc." Or, "We don't want to work with the Italians, Germans, etc." I know that there has to be a shift in how people relate to each other. I remembered a report we received about food ratings on our ship, the Constitution. I thought about its sister ship, Independence, and visualized the way each ship mirrored each other and each wanted to yell, "Aloha!" louder than the other. I remembered that man whose day was brighter because he incorrectly thought he saw a dolphin. The kitchen staff needed their own dolphin. I came in the next day, holding transfer slips in my right hand, and proclaimed, "If any of you want to be second best, go join the Independents. Here on the Constitution, we are the best." Most of the workstations were mixed, so I came to these stations and said, "This is the best damn roasting station in the company," or, "I wish all stations worked as well as you guys do." I always made it a point to say these things in front of every person in the station. When I exaggerated my praise, they worked harder. The idea of a rivalry between the ships quickly took, and whenever a worker would mess up, others would poke fun. "Indy, Indy." It helped create a sense of shared identity, bestness. But the truly wonderful part was that by putting the idea in their minds that they were the best, people wanted to actually do their best to live up to the idea. Workers worked better together, and we ended up having higher food ratings than the Independents. I won favor with people because I am good at picking up on nuances of social interaction. I always notice the details. For instance, the kitchen staff was composed of several different ethnic identities, and each one had distinct values. The workers from Palau revered elders in their community, and the eldest of them on the ship was a first cook. Even though he didn't have high rank in the kitchen, people from his community respected him more than they respected high-ranking ship officers. Culture was very important to them, and many supervisors didn't understand this. There came a time when I needed the shrimp cocktail station to work faster, so I walked up to the lead cook and exclaimed, "Uncle Tommy," as he liked people to call him, "how is your family?" He beamed and started to talk to me about his grandchildren. He was a Palauan elder. The younger cooks continued poaching mounds of shrimp, listening without raising their eyes. I came in close to Tom, as though I were confiding in him, and whispered, "Hey, Uncle Tommy, you have to help me get Natalie and Wazelle to work faster because we really need to keep up." He replied, Oh, yes, I agree." I was Tom's superior, but I understood that if I approached him as a subordinate, it would undermine my objective and possibly create tension with all the other Palauan workers. Instead, the old man's cultural status had been acknowledged and he solved the problem. Later, another Palauan worker said, "Oh, I like Rodriguez. He respects people from Palau." Everyone is happy. While cruising took me to exotic places and all kinds of adventures, time spent at sea is its own pleasure. Sometimes, when you sail, you can't see any other ship in any direction. It feels like you're the only thing in the world, just you and endless ocean. On nights like this, the night is so dark, the only light came from the moon and stars, which looked like shimmering jewels suspended in the sky. Sometimes I would come onto the deck in the early morning, and there was hardly a wave to break the surface, so the ocean looked like glass because the water was so still. Once, while crossing the Indian Ocean, we encountered a swarm of flying fish at night, many of which landed on the deck, each making a loud flop on the deck as it landed. We ran around, throwing them back in the ocean. Another time, we were at sea around Indonesia, a place called Tiger's Eye, known for underwater cyclones. It was in this place that we caught the lip of one once, and the ship was jarred sharply. Another time, our ship was hit by a rogue wave. This was a large, single wave rolling on the ocean. It hit us so hard, the ship almost went over on its side before the ship corrected itself. I remember being in the kitchen at the time. One minute I'm working at a station, then suddenly I'm pushed against a wall, at an angle steep enough that I could have crawled along the wall for the brief moment the ship was broadsided. Lacking a large keel, the ship could have been pushed over enough to take on water and sink. The men that worked in the lower decks got the worst of it, and this was one of the few times that I saw grown men cry. The worst storm I ever lived through happened while we were cruising around Hawaii when three storms covered the entire area. Usually when there was a storm, the ship would swing around to the other side of the closest islands, where the water was calm. But this time, there were storms coming from all sides. We were out to sea for 3 days while 25-foot waves battered the ship, making it sway back and forth. For dinner service, we had to tie down all pots, or else they would slide off and spill their contents. The wind was strong enough to cause heavy metal tables to fly off the decks and into the ocean. After witnessing this, the captain ordered everyone off of the open decks. In a moment of extreme bravery or foolishness, I crawled onto the deck with a friend in yellow rain jackets to the backup bridge, which is located on the lower deck at the stern. I grabbed the wheel and for that instant felt alive against the wrath of the ocean, which looked like a monster, as dark hills of sea churned and crashed into one another and into the ship. We took a picture of us holding the ship's wheel with the storm in the background. The picture captured my Moby Dick moment. Thankfully, neither one of us was tossed overboard, for had we would have surely been lost. It was a terrible couple of nights, and I saw many people kiss the ground at the port of Hilo when we were finally allowed to dock after the storm subsided. As a chef, I love flavors, indulging the senses through culinary art and the shared experience of dining. I wanted people to think life was wonderful when they sat down for dinner. Being off the coast of Morocco as a red-orange sunset filled the sky, it was hard to think life was anything but wonderful. Each country and each region had a unique taste. I think the personality of a people is revealed in the seasoning of their foods. Moroccan seasoning in particular is rich, complex, bold, with a hint of honeyed sweetness. No matter where we were, be it the Mediterranean, Arabia, South Asia, Northern Europe, our location influenced what we presented. We used seasoning purchased at local markets. In West Africa, I found cloves, peppercorns, cardamom, and cinnamon, all very high quality and a simple way to support local economies. While in Morocco, one of my favorite things to make was tender lamb tagine with almond, raisin, and mint. I cooked to reflect the tastes of the places we visited, and I believed that a person could better experience a place through our cooking than by walking around tourist spots. I loved being a chef because I could engage all my senses in a creative endeavor. Cooking is a multi-sensory experience that befits a visual thinker. The interesting thing about visual thinking and cooking is that the visual quality of food is just one dimension. Applying visual thinking to food is not just about how food looks. It's about envisioning flavors, seeing taste, textures, combinations, and subtleties. Even after all these years, I have an index of all these food characteristics in my mind, each one fresh and intact. The vibrancy of setting orange liqueur aflame, the effervescent sizzle of a Chilean sea bass, the halo of smoothness of white truffle. Food was also my way of celebrating life. If you have good food and good company, you are a rich man. When I worked on the ship, dining lasted several hours. I tried to only make memorable meals. In addition to experimenting with local cuisine, I made the classics. I made beef bourguignon, chateaubriand in bordelaise sauce, ossobuco, veal chops in chanterelle sauce, sabayon with wild berries, among many other favorites. One of the benefits of working on a smaller luxury cruise ship was its collection of specialty foods. We had 5-pound tins of Russian caviar, black and pearly. For myself, I liked to spread the caviar on fresh-baked bread smeared with butter. We couldn't serve it this way, but it was a personal indulgence. Another way I liked it, which we did serve, was on split langostinos filled with sour cream, caviar, garnished with finely chopped red onion and finely chopped boiled egg. I ate quite a bit of caviar when I worked on the ships. It's not the sort of thing that gets boring. I remember the stories of fishermen in the Caspian Sea being executed for illegally catching sturgeon. Caviar is big, serious, sometimes scary business. I visited Egypt many times, each visit affording me a few days to explore with my fellow crew members. I remember Egypt smelling like spiced tea. I traveled to the Great Pyramids, down the Nile to Luxor, and the Valley of the Kings. One of the most beautiful places was the Temple of Hatshepsut, the longest-living female pharaoh of Egypt. The temple is carved into a mountain of rock and is beautifully preserved for its age. The limestone walls depict many vivid scenes of victories, celestial bodies, and telling stories about moving through dimensions. Around the Nile, Egypt is lush and green. Beyond that, it was arid, sandy, and rocky in varying degrees. The land feels ancient and like it's hiding something. The people were friendly and curious about Americans, and in this ancient land, people most often asked me about Hollywood with as much awe as I felt about their home. Some places made me feel as though I had traveled through time. I recall coming to port in places like Safaga and thinking the panorama was probably the same as that seen by sailors of long ago. I was told Egyptian pharaohs used to wear red coral jewelry, and I saw the coral myself when I dove in the Red Sea. We dove about 120 feet to swim around coral, remnants of ancient shipwrecks, hammerhead sharks, and all kinds of large fish that stare you in the eye. During one of my favorite dives, I swam after a pufferfish covered in tiny spikes. I followed it around coral and crevices until it puffed up from its 5-inch length to about a foot in diameter. At that point, I left it alone and swam away. Sometimes we dove at night, traveling about half an hour away from the shore before reaching our spot. When you dive at night, you can't see anything except for about 5 feet of light cast by your underwater lights. One time, we ran into a large Spanish dancer fish, which is red and translucent. It resembles a piece of cloth moving through the water. I remember we flashed our lights through it, and thought it looked otherworldly. I was fearless back then, but today I am slightly unnerved at the prospect of big fish watching you in the darkness when you cannot see them. During night dives, you have to follow your bubbles back to the surface, or else find yourself disoriented in the dark. I consider this to be a good allegory for finding your way home, no matter where you are. I also had some close calls. Once, we stopped to refuel in Djibouti, a country in the Horn of Africa. We were advised of strict social customs and various dangers. Many passengers refused to leave the ship. Some passengers felt brave enough to travel into town by bus, but none left the bus, and the driver quickly returned them to the ship. Along with other crew members, I left the ship for the afternoon. We took a taxi into town to visit the Bedouin marketplace. By comparison to Egypt, the buildings here were much simpler, and the town square was populated by tents, which meant that the whole marketplace could disappear overnight. I got the feeling that people wanted to have the option of leaving quickly if need be. We were looking at leather goods, silverwork, jewels, and swords. We were making some purchases when our friend Ronnie, a waiter from Denmark, strayed from the group to take pictures of local women. Needless to say, this was a very bad idea on his part. In our briefing on the ship, we were warned about many things, among them not to take pictures. The surrounding people became very upset at his actions. Women threw food and stones at him. Men were yelling and brandishing daggers. At this point, we saw him run past us down the dusty dirt road. A crowd of about 40 people quickly formed and started coming after the whole group, myself included. We knew we had to get out of there, so we all ran toward the taxi. I ran as though my life depended on it, about which I was likely correct. Our taxi driver had observed the entire scene and was now driving toward us, turning quickly and sliding open the van door. We had to jump into the moving taxi to head for the port. I think the port was notified because when we arrived, we were met by half a dozen officers pointing rusty machine guns at us. They were trying to grab Ronnie during some angry exchanges. We were lucky enough to be joined by a crew member from France who spoke Arabic, who was able to translate for us. The officers claimed Ronnie was a reporter and that we had to go with them. You never want to see the inside of a foreign prison, but it seemed like something we should want to avoid even more so here. Our translator implored them to let us go, saying we were tourists and worked on the cruise ship in port. We were held for some time among whispers before they accepted the roll of film from our friend's camera and a couple $100. I remember my great relief as I reached the ship. We were all enraged with the waiter-turned-photographer, and we didn't forgive him until we reached Kenya. I didn't fault the local people for the incident, believing it was up to us to respect the customs of the places we visited, but I never returned to Djibouti. My last trip on sea was a 40-day cruise with stops in Denmark, Holland, France, Italy, Greece, Syria, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, India, Thailand, Malaysia, and ending with a series of short cruises between Singapore and Bali. I had crossed half of the world. On a typically hot and humid evening in Bali, I started outlining some of this book on napkins between cocktails. But even though I started writing the story, I didn't yet know where it was heading. What I did know was that this would be my final venture on sea. I was in my sixth year abroad and had traveled to over 60 countries. Part of me felt like a fool for leaving a life full of adventure, beautiful cities, and great food and drink. But the luster of this life had faded. The parties had become predictable. I came to this position wanting to explore the unknown. I stayed because I fell in love with living and working at sea. Even now, I remember the salted air, the ocean breeze, and the warm sun on my face, and for an instant, I am transported and the mystique returns. But back then, my life on the ocean felt like it was no longer enough. I thought about my life's purpose. I wanted more. Chapter 6. At the Foot of the Mountain. I could still remember sitting on a beach in Bali, surrounded by the warm evening air that smelled of spiced coconut, sandalwood, thick ripened mango, and sea breeze. Now I was sitting on the 14-hour flight to London, which would be followed by a 9-hour flight to Los Angeles. You know that feeling you get when coming home from a relaxing vacation? It feels like you danced just a little too much, and you still feel the whisper of that last drink. But your skin soaked up the sun, and you just feel at peace, like a long day at the beach. That's how I felt on my trip back, multiplied by 6 years. When the plane touched down, I had no feelings of coming home. While the ship was a traveling home of sorts, it did not feel like a definite place I could call home. My parents' home was not my home either. Even though I had amassed savings, I am technically homeless, but I feel as free as ever, so it does not matter to me. I feel as though I'm riding a wave of accomplishment that had a swelling momentum. Success seems to beget success. Breaking through to success is harder than staying successful. I found that once I started doing the things I wanted to do in my life, and once I became really good at doing those things, I just landed on opportunity after opportunity. A long time ago, I read a book that said, "When you want something, all the universe conspires in helping you to achieve it." It's true. Between hotels and visiting my family, I meet up with a lot of old friends. One of them is my chef instructor, whom I visited at the construction of a new culinary school. The cement was still drying in some parts of the building, but the kitchens were fully operational and pristine. We walked through the building together, catching up and sharing stories. He was now one of the founding partners at this new school. "How would you like to teach a class here?" "I could do great things with international cuisine," he persuaded, before giving me a ballpark number. I had not come here looking for a job, and I had never formally taught students, but I figure, why not? So I say, "All right," and so begins my teaching career. I pull my chef's jacket and toque off the hanger in my office and walk to my classroom. Everyone in my class wears a white jacket, and mine is one of the perfectly tailored French jackets I acquired during my work abroad. The toque is my tall chef's hat that is creased and folded 100 ways, for the 100 ways to prepare an egg, the myth goes. I wear black slacks, but my students must wear checkered pants that denote their student status. The first classes outline teaching procedures and methods, then a series of knife skills, and today we actually work with ingredients for the first time. I know that my students are eager to learn complex dishes, but today we are learning how to make a tomato sauce, which may be more multifaceted than you think. "How do you know a good tomato?" "Color," says one student. "Texture," says another. "Give it a squeeze," says one jokester. Wrong, wrong, wrong. The way to know a good tomato is smell. I tell them I will teach them how to make a tomato sauce that won't make an Italian grandmother cry. I pull out two tomatoes, nearly identical in size and color. "What does this smell like to you?" I ask them as I bring the tomato to their noses. "Nothing." Tomatoes that smell like nothing are lousy. They immediately smell the good tomato, which smells like a tomato. Nothing else smells like it, but you should be able to smell the smoothness of the vine. We peel the tomato by scoring it with a knife on top and bottom, then tossing it into boiling water until the edges curl a bit, then plunge them into ice water. We can now peel them easily, leaving the fleshy bulbs. Cut them in half, removing the seeds. We collect the juice and rough chop the tomato. Garlic and onion need to be minced with a sharp knife, never smashed by a food processor. Fresh oregano, basil, parsley, and a touch of thyme. Dried herbs are gritty. A red wine for body. Prep your pan with olive oil. Sauté the garlic first until lightly golden, then add in the onion until translucent. Everything should shh when it hits the pan. Add in the tomatoes and juice, which cook down. Deglaze with your red wine, but make sure it lands directly on the pan. We add a bit of tomato paste to take the edge off. Simmer for 30 minutes, then add the fresh herbs. Simmer for 10 minutes, adjust seasoning. Mwah! Teaching my students the nuances of cuisine was only part of what makes a great chef. The other part comes from the drive to create something extraordinary and outdo oneself. I knew competition was one way to foster this attitude, so I created a culinary team to represent the school. A bold move for a new school that was competing against established schools. We competed in both cuisine and ice sculpting, which I taught the team. The students timidly shaved the ice because everyone was afraid of breaking the block. So I had them make simple sculptures, and we took them behind the school to smash them, so as to get the fear out. It worked, and it was also incredibly enjoyable, to my visual mind, to see the massive blocks crack and be blown apart under the weight of them falling onto the concrete. I enrolled our team at the Western Food Service and Hospitality Expo culinary competition held at the Los Angeles Convention Center. When I shared the news, I could tell some of my students were excited while others doubted their abilities to compete on such a large stage. I told them I knew what it took to compete at such a high level and that we would get there together. My students worked incredibly hard and helped each other refine their skills. The competition came with entrance fees, so I decided we would raise funds by selling snow cones at a festival in Orange County. It was summertime, and snow cones are easy, move fast, and have good profit margins. We raised more than enough to pay the fees. The big day came, and our marlin fish, carved out of a single block of ice, placed silver against competitors from the entire western United States. "We've never heard of your school," one group said when they saw the medals around my students' necks. "Now you have," I said. The team competed in several more competitions, and eventually we ended up at the World Ice Art Championship in Fairbanks, Alaska. Whenever you were outside, you could see your breath, and we had to wear full-body snowsuits just to be outside. The air was thinner, and we got tired more easily, so we had to load up on calories while there. We took advantage of an all-you-can-drink hot chocolate bar and placed 9th out of 40 teams that had made the trek up to Alaska for the 48-hour and 5,000-pound ice challenge. My original intention when I started working at the school was to accept a one-semester position. That turned into 5 years. Over the course of that time, I helped groom many chefs. Competitions helped the student visualize a goal, and this skill was effective in having them set and reach their personal and professional aspirations. Around the end of year 5, I looked back on an extensive body of work as a chef, sculptor, and teacher. I thought about my own aspirations, much like I did that day on the beach in Bali. Despite my varied success, my mind keeps returning to one fact. I never went to college. Of course, I didn't need to go to college to have financial or professional success, because I already had that. But a college education seemed to me an integral part of being a man, and more specifically, a gentleman. School felt like unfinished business. A decade has elapsed since I dropped out of high school, and although I had passed the California High School Proficiency Exam and obtained credentials as a chef and vocational instructor, I couldn't get the image of college out of my brain. So one day I decided to leave. My colleagues and students were sad to see me go, but I felt as though I was unfurling the sails of a figurative ship once again. In what was either my greatest act of bravery or my greatest act of foolishness, I enrolled in community college. I would be lying if I said the prospect of becoming a student again didn't send a chill up my spine. After all, that place marked the lowest part of my life. I felt more scared about school than I ever did about being tossed about in a ship on a churning ocean, diving 120 feet underwater in pitch blackness, or jumping out of a plane strapped to a parachute I hoped would open, or running from armed Djiboutians. But I had a bit of a sweat on my brow as I walked to my first class, Remedial English. Remedial. I was starting so low the class didn't even have grades. It was a pass, not pass class to get students up to level. The class met twice per week and covered subjects like parts of speech, grammar, the basics of paragraph structure, and free writing, which was basically you writing anything that was in your head. The people sitting next to me are taking the class because English was their second language. And here I am, struggling alongside them even though English is my first and only language. But it doesn't bother me. I think back to what I know well. Ice sculpting. I decide that as long as I can come to really understand the basics, I can apply them in limitless ways. But the key is understanding how English, or any other subject, really works. Understanding is different from sitting in a class and getting a good grade. Visual thinkers are actually pretty good at understanding. you can visualize the connections and apply that network of connections to new problems, creating new answers. I also discovered that my class subjects and their assignments worked like puzzles. I could finally wrap my head around that. However, the best thing I ever did for myself and the one thing I would recommend to any person going back to school and definitely to any person with a learning disability in school, take it slow. I took only 2 classes in my first semester at school. If you have a learning disability, I think it is downright foolish to start with more. Why? Because we have to approach classes in such a painstaking, thorough, careful way that you don't have enough time to do all that in 4 different classes at the same time. I built up my skills with 2 classes at a time. Eventually, I added a 3rd or even 4th class. There was no way I could have done this except at community college. High school doesn't work like this, and 4-year colleges don't work like this unless you can be approved to take a reduced course load due to having a documented learning disability. I didn't even know I had a learning disability at this point, but at community college, anyone can take just 1 or 2 classes, no questions asked. In my first semester, I take both the remedial English class and an art history class. Thinking about the classes as puzzles is my saving grace. It's the visual way of approaching classes. Linear, non-visual thinking students had an approach that was much different. I realized I failed in my earlier education because I was forced into the linear method of learning. On the first day of class, our professor passed out the class syllabus that outlined all the subjects, reading, and assignments for the semester. But most students would just tuck it away in a folder and refer to it when they needed to know what their homework was that night. They listened to lectures as a sequence of information, which may build on itself in a logical way. I had to do things differently. The class subject had to be assembled in my mind like a puzzle, and the professor's syllabus was a rough map. So I analyzed the syllabus carefully to get an idea of the broad sections of the class. From the syllabus, I could also infer what sections were the most foundational, or even of most interest to the professor. With a rough idea of the puzzle in mind, I attended classes with the purpose of filling in the spaces. Not only did I have to understand the small pieces, but I also had to know how those pieces interacted with one another. To put it another way, professors love to set up a foundation of information like a landscape. Then they might flesh out smaller subjects within that foundation. Trees here, plants there. Finally, they add in questions that crisscross the subjects like birds flying across the landscape in different ways. Oh, and your perspective of the landscape might affect how you interpret it, so be sure to try to move that landscape on an axis of various factors. Years later, someone told me, "Don't miss the forest because you're lost in the trees." Good advice. I seem to be naturally good with people because I catch the nuances of our interaction and enjoy talking to people more than I will ever enjoy writing or reading. So when the professor, his assistant, and the Community College Learning Center informed me that I could go to them with questions, I believed them. I think of them as counselors and co-conspirators on my educational path. When I visit them, I am most surprised at the fact that I'm one of only a handful of people who are taking advantage of these resources. I used them to help me put together the puzzle of the class subject, but also to work on assignments, which were like mini-puzzles of the class. It's actually not difficult to talk to a professor about his or her class, because the class is usually something they really care about, and people love talking about themselves or the things they love. So if I had a paper to write, I first thought about the puzzle of the class in general, then I started to think about how this mini-puzzle fit into the larger puzzle. With this in mind, I visit the professor's assistant, if any, and get information, or talked about it with a study group of students I had joined. Then I took my thoughts to my professor's office hours, where I was able to fill in the puzzle even more. Next, I took all this information and my writing down to the Student Learning Center, where they could help me structure and refine my paper. Sometimes this involved doing the process a few times in order to get a good final product. But the last step was having a friend proofread for spelling and grammar, because I often missed the errors. That's how I was able to produce good quality work in my classes, and the process is super time-intensive, so you can see why I could only take a few classes at a time. When professors passed out an assignment or paper topics, I couldn't wait, like other students, until the night before the due date to write my paper. I started my work the day after, or even later that day, or even during that class period. The end of the semester came. I survived the final exams. And a few weeks later, I checked my grades online. English, pass. Art history, A-. When I read the screen, I became ecstatic. Getting A's was possible for someone like me. Chapter 7. Checkmate. After this first semester, I realized that in order to succeed in school, I need to strategize. I never had a strategy before. Throughout high school, I had been a passive participant in my education. I had no control over my classes, teachers, schedule, or workload. But now, I am in a place where I can forge my own path and use everything I have learned in the real world to my advantage. I know myself well. I perform my best when I work with passionate people, when I could be creative, and when I could work at my own pace. So I made these factors into a guideline for building my class schedule. One of the biggest reasons for deciding to take or drop a class depends on the professor. Do they have a passion for what they teach? I walk into one math class where the professor has wiry white hair and wears a rumpled shirt, big eyes that look just a little wild, and an easily excitable demeanor about him. I glance around the room and could see question marks on my classmates' faces. My first instinct is to put his class in my definitely take category. I like my professors to have a little madness to them, so long as they can make me think. These are the best professors for someone like me. Any professor who lacked a command of the material, spoke in a monotone voice, or looked bored is an immediate drop. Once I narrow my list down to passionate instructors, I start to focus on other things I know will help me succeed. Because of the importance of not falling behind on work, only classes with a manageable workload could make it onto my schedule. For this reason, I took a careful look at the reading material, exams, and scheduling of each class before I decided to take it. I evaluate the course reading in inches. How thick is the stack of required reading? I knew how much time it took me to read, so I needed to be vigilant about not signing up for more than I could handle. My government class only used 2 books. The professor shared most of the information in lectures. Visual thinkers don't think in words, but we can understand them exponentially better when they are spoken. Lectures feel like stories, and this works well with my puzzle approach to understanding the class subject. I'm not the kind of student who takes many notes. Instead, I need to listen intently, another reason why professors had to be able to hold my attention. Exams were another thing I had to strategize. I knew I had limitations in reading and writing, so final exams were always a challenge. My favorite exams were those that asked for short answers, projects, or take-home finals. I thought these forms of testing made best use of my skills while minimizing my weak points. It didn't always work out. Sometimes I had an exam that required me to write several in-class essays. This was one of my biggest academic challenges, so if I knew I had an intense writing final, I would balance it with other finals that did not require much writing. One exam that I'm thankful I never took is the SAT. I did not take it in high school, and my community college did not require it. Standardized tests are one of the most daunting tasks a student with a learning disability can undertake. One of the biggest strategic advantages of attending community college for students like me is that you do not need to take standardized tests like the SAT or ACT to enroll. Many 4-year universities do not ask transfer students to provide these test scores either. I was very glad to know this, as I am the sort of test taker that misses bubbles and may incorrectly bubble my own name even before a single exam question has been asked. These tests are like walls that keep many students with learning disabilities from attending 4-year colleges. While some people decide to struggle and scale those walls, I just walked around them. Not having to take those big standardized tests is one of the reasons why I was able to attend UC Berkeley and Harvard. I never had to take a standardized test to get into either school. Perhaps if a bad score had been there, it would have reflected poorly on me. I know visual thinkers are always up for a challenge, but dyslexics are at a strategic disadvantage in taking standardized tests, even with accommodations. Moreover, many experts have criticized standardized testing as a poor measure of future college performance for everyone, no matter whether they are visual thinkers or language thinkers. But they hurt students with learning disabilities, especially those that affect reading like dyslexia, the most. Just imagine, the test makers make it difficult for language thinkers to finish all the questions in the time constraints. I like to think the testing companies are run by evil people who relish in asking, "Choose the best of all possible answers." Those are the worst, when the difference between a correct and incorrect answer is a minor difference in phrasing. The ability to read the options quickly and closely is your most valuable tool. For me, the problem was time. It was always running out. I never understood why an hour could feel like an eternity if I had to sit still, but if I had to read something and answer questions, time felt like water slipping through my hands. "Time," our exam proctor would call, and all I could do was look at all of the questions that had gone unbubbled with anxiety as I moved on to the next timed section. In addition to the struggles of the exam, sometimes the mere process of signing up for the exam can be frustrating. Some testing companies also have notoriously poor compliance with accommodations for students with disabilities. And I don't just mean learning disabilities, but disabilities in general. I met one woman in college who was blind and had to go through a legal battle in her attempts to get an examiner to read the test questions to her aloud because she was denied the right to use a braille writer and paper. She eventually won the matter a year later, but only after an unnecessary amount of resistance from the testing company. So, standardized testing can be a struggle even before you sit down to take the exam. One day, I came across a flyer. It was not the only flyer that would change my life during college, either. This one was for a program called Puente, which means bridge in Spanish, and they were a bridge to college for many others and me. While I had a lot of drive and eagerness to become educated in the broad sense, I was pretty aimless when it came to having specific schools on my horizon. It was through this student program that I visited my first university. I was a high school dropout who was trying to get out of remedial courses in community college when I visited my first grand university campus. Walking into Berkeley for the first time felt as though I was walking into Athens when I looked up at the imposing white classical structures and listened to the lively chatter that pervaded the campus. I knew immediately it was where I wanted to be, so much that by the time I got back home, I had already decided my next move. 7 weeks later, I have packed my car to the brim, and I trudge up California on Highway 5 to Berkeley. The school had not even accepted me yet, but I just know I have to be there. My gut instinct tells me it's the right thing to do. When I arrive in Berkeley, I manage to squeeze into some student-run housing close to campus. It was not glamorous, but it was the only place I could afford at the time. Students had to sign up for scheduled work around the place, cooking, cleaning, gardening, in order to offset the expenses. This was fine for me, and I always chose to participate in making big Sunday dinners. I lived in a 3-bedroom apartment, and my roommates were interesting characters. One was a filmmaker, and the other was a Marine reservist. I thought Berkeley was the perfect place to be a student, and unlike any place I had ever visited. But it was a major university, and I was only in community college. I enrolled in the local community college with still a year left before I could apply to 4-year colleges. I took advantage of a program that allowed me to take one class at UC Berkeley as long as I was taking my other classes at the community college. A week after arriving in Berkeley, I started an introductory anthropology course at the university and a public speaking class at the community college. In this new city, I made one of the most important discoveries about myself. It happened randomly. I came across a student flyer while waiting for my class to begin. It listed the signs of dyslexia. As I read the signs over and over, slow and awkward reading, confuses words that sound alike, messy writing, avoids reading out loud and avoids saying words that might be mispronounced, etc. I thought, hey, this flyer sounds like it was written about me. I was intrigued and I could not get this new word, dyslexia, out of my mind. I thought about it for a few days before I decided to do something. I returned to the bulletin board that had the flyer and pulled it down. The flyer had the phone number to the Disabled Students Program at Berkeley City College. I decided to go to the office, and not long after I did, I was taking a barrage of tests over a few days. I tried my best on the exams, a part of me thinking that maybe I didn't have dyslexia and my problems were some unexplainable deficiency in me. When I returned the next week for my results, they confirmed that I had dyslexia. In addition to demonstrating various patterns in my performance, I had shown a discrepancy that was characteristic of dyslexia, scoring very low on a specific set of cognitive processes while scoring very high on others. I learned that this impediment affected the pace at which I read and the manner in which my brain processed symbols and information. It was one of the biggest aha moments of my life. Everything I had felt growing up, the self-doubt, the frustration, the taunts, and the failure, it was all explained in an instant. It was an incredible moment for me. I was excited to find answers to why I do certain things and why reading and writing is such a struggle for me. Suddenly, everything made sense. I did not feel ashamed about having dyslexia. What a great personal revelation. I wasn't unintelligent. There was a reason why I read so slowly. This is why I had trouble writing. Everyone who called me dumb when I was a boy was wrong. I wish I could have found out sooner. A counselor at the Student Disability Center informed me that because of the diagnosis, I could get accommodations in my classes. For a dyslexic student, this meant having modifications to certain assignments, extra time on exams, and a note taker. These few adjustments made my life better because for the first time in my life, I was able to take more classes and still learn at a comfortable pace. People with learning disabilities have to cope with the fact that their disabilities are invisible. That is, until the patterns of dyslexia are revealed in writing and speech. Accommodations worked mainly to make up for my slow reading and writing. My grades in reading-intensive classes improved, but I still had to work really hard. A few classroom accommodations weren't enough. Even with extra time on an in-class essay, I still needed to convey my thoughts in writing, my arch-nemesis. Eventually, I came to see accommodations as bandages on a much larger problem. The dyslexic mind thinks differently. It has an approach to learning that is markedly different from linear thinking. Thus, even if I had extra time on a written exam, I was still on shaky ground. Remember how I scored really high in certain cognitive processes? I decided I wanted to access that part of my brain as much as possible because I was aiming for A's in my classes. I developed additional strategies to help my success. I already knew the logistics of getting a decent class schedule, and I had invested a lot of energy into slow and careful studying, but I realized I needed something more. I started doing something I called the rule of three, in which I tried to learn something in three different ways. I tried to grasp one language-based way and figure out two visual ways of understanding. I got better at associating ideas and facts I learned in class with images in the panorama of my mind. In conversations I've had with linear thinkers, I see that they learn by building an idea on another idea. By comparison, my dyslexic learning felt more like an attempt to pin down a wild animal, grasping at one leg here and then grasping at another limb there until I can hold the entire thing in my mind. I was immersed in the college culture and I loved it. Late fall of that year, I applied to UC Berkeley. I was able to describe at length why I wanted to attend UC Berkeley because I knew the campus so well after spending a summer and most of fall there. This was just another example of how valuable it was to get to really know the people and place where you are being considered, whether it is a school or some other prospect. Admissions people routinely decry the way some applicants describe their school and its programs inaccurately. But I made no simple mistakes. I could tell you the way Berkeley smells after a rain, or how the fog rolls during the early morning hours, and the campanile, the campus tower, looks as if it's floating in a sea of clouds. By November 30th, my applications were submitted, and all I could do now was wait and hope for the best. I finished my fall semester on a high note, earning mostly A's. The wait was arduous. I still remember the week before I was to find out if I was accepted or not to UC Berkeley. It was the longest week of my life. I had already received acceptance letters from UC Davis, UC Santa Cruz, and UC Riverside, and I still hadn't heard from UC Berkeley. This was the reason I moved to the city of Berkeley, California, to learn more about UC Berkeley so I would have a better chance of being accepted there. I would find out in 7 days if I would be attending Berkeley. I wished time would move faster. To help pass the time, I tried to sleep more, hoping I would wake up to the news of my fate. My confidence soon changed to nervousness as 7 days became 3, and 3 became 1. In my head, I reviewed every detail of my Berkeley application, from my personal statement, to my transcript, to the description of the various jobs I held over the years. I just hoped it would be enough. My roommate at the time asked me if I was feeling well, because I wasn't able to sleep well or eat very much as the hours ticked away closer and closer to my moment of judgment. The day I was to find whether or not I was accepted, I woke up at 6 a.m. My eyes shot open, and I was unable to fall asleep again no matter how hard I tried. Results would be available at 11 a.m. on the Berkeley website. I must have logged onto the site a few dozen times before my scheduled time just to see if it showed anything new. When the final minutes approached, I just hit refresh on my keyboard over and over. Suddenly, the screen shined the words, "Congratulations, you've been accepted to UC Berkeley." I fell off my chair in the excitement, kicking my legs and punching my fists in the air as my back hit the floor. That week, I received a fancy acceptance letter from UC Berkeley in the mail and embarked on my new life. As I held the thick letter in my hand, cooking and sculpting seemed like remnants of my past. I was at a new table, and this was a feast unlike any I had ever had before. I was now a student at one of the finest universities in the world. Me, the kid whose teacher said he would never read, could finally walk through Sather Gate and belong. Me, the guy who clawed his way through community college even when people told me it would never amount to anything. Checkmate. Chapter 8. An Interview to Remember. I had a brief career in baseball. I played in our local Little League when I was 10 years old, and it's hard to look back without waxing romantic. Once you get to my age, you sometimes forget how old you have become. Today, you can plop down on a cushion, and instantly you're a major league player. As enjoyable as video games can be, in my opinion, nothing comes close to the real thing. Breathe in the freshly cut grass and catch a whiff of that powdery chalk that marks the lines. The sunniness of the afternoon. Parents on lawn chairs, little brothers biting into homemade sandwiches, sisters wearing sundresses. My mom had washed my uniform, crisp, white and blue. It's clean now, but I'll be real dirty by the end of this game. Most of the fun is in the dirt, with your friends, just playing the game, with the hope that the day will end at the pizza parlor with your whole team. I have my favorite glove, which I've rubbed with oil and worked over and over for countless hours to soften the tough leather. I put it under my mattress at night to crush it even more, and now it's molded to my hand. A shiny, pristine glove is the worst thing. The moving parts of the game play well to my 3D thinking brain. During my stint as a baseball player, I learned one important thing. It's not about hitting the ball. It's about outwitting the pitcher. See the pitcher. See the arch. See the ball lunging at you. Feel the swing of your bat. And, the best feeling ever, connect. Slam. Fast forward a few decades. It is now June, and I'm starting day one of a highly anticipated internship in Sacramento, California. Internships are those things where you work for free in exchange for experience, which can leave you feeling accomplished or swindled, depending on how the summer goes. I walked eagerly to my office, ready for my first day. Well, not my office exactly. I had no office space, except for the space I took up whenever I was in my state assembly member's office. But I was inspired nonetheless. Spending all that time thinking about Machiavelli, the founders, and the purpose of government in political theory class paid off. Yes, I know how to make double-sided copies. The summer in the Capitol would be more than that, of course, but I'll never know for certain. After a day filled with handshaking, memorizing faces and struggling to remember names, learning my surroundings, and lots of running around the Capitol building, I walked out into the hot air of a Sacramento summer night. I returned